This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
The most important thing we got to do is to continue to organize and mobilize. Now, from UNAC, that's United National Anti-War Coalition, we called for coordinated local actions on the Martin Luther King Week.
Anti-war groups in the U.S. continue to uplift the true legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King and his fight against racism, poverty, and war.
The ANC government is not in a position to solve any of the basic problems inside the country because the requirement of neoliberalism is cuts on social spending in general. They were warned, upgrade the grid. They failed to do so.
Regular and sudden massive power shortages are threatening jobs, health, and the future of South Africa.
I call on President Biden to step up. Come on, this is ridiculous. Drop the charges and free Julian Assange.
Attorney Steve Dunzinger, speaking at the Belmarsh Tribunal in Washington, D.C., as calls to free imprisoned WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange continue to mount.
The inspiration and blessing shared among one another today is a lifelong reminder of how long we remember those that came before us.
And a message of peace and blessings from the Squally Tribal Elder, David Thunderbear. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Aku Holt. While war continues to rage in the Ukraine and threatens to spill beyond borders, anti-war groups in the U.S. are doing a slow build in the hopes that sufficient resistance will catalyze in time to prevent a global catastrophe. Don DeBar files this report on the holiday events honoring Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I was in Ukraine in May, and we had to see for ourselves what the hell is going on. And I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Ukrainian military not only is attacking civilians, but especially in the Donbass region, their military is led by Nazi forces, the Azov Battalion, IDARS, Vovota.
That was anti-war activist John Parker from the Socialist Unity Party speaking at one of the dozens of anti-NATO, anti-war rallies and marches held across the U.S. over the King holiday weekend. Nearly 100 actions were posted at the website of the United National Anti-War Coalition, or UNAC, at unacpeace.org. The frantic organizing for peace in Ukraine comes almost 20 years to the day after millions poured into the streets on February 15, 2003, then demanding that the U.S. not make war on Iraq. It was the largest anti-war protest in the history of the world, with millions around the world joining in. Nevertheless, the U.S. began the war a month later, kicking it off with a massive bombing campaign that Washington dubbed Shock and Awe. Since then, the anti-war movement has appeared to be a ghost of its former self, despite intensive organizing against the wars on Libya and Syria during the Obama administration. The war in Ukraine, however, threatens to become a much larger war, one that could well end up being fought not just over there, but over here as well, and with nuclear weapons. To try to gain an understanding of what those in the anti-war movement are thinking, we spoke with two members of UNAC's National Board, both longtime anti-war activists, Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center and Margaret Kimberly of the Black Alliance for Peace. This was Sarah Flounders.
No one is really for this war. They've been silenced, yes. And the role of the media is always to marginalize, make it seem insignificant, irrelevant to their war plans. Their role is to marginalize the deep opposition to this war.
Yeah.
They want to project an image that they are all powerful. And actually, what in fact has happened is that they have utterly failed in this war to bring down Russia, which they announced they would do in short order, in days and weeks, that the Russian economy would collapse.
Yep.
And instead, what has happened is it's had a disastrous impact on the European Union. Now, that's also to the U.S. benefit. They wanted to break. German trade with Russia was 10 times German trade with the U.S. They've succeeded in breaking that. Mm. Now, the people throughout Europe will pay a terrible price for this war. But the war profiteers are making out better than they even did on Iraq or Afghanistan. So they are 110% for this war. The most important thing we got to do is to continue to organize and mobilize. Now, from UNAC, that's United National Anti-War Coalition, we called for coordinated local actions on the Martin Luther King Week. We are now up to, there's 86 different events we've listed as of today. Now, that's not in the millions, no, but that means in cities, towns, areas across the country, there are people organizing, planning events, building local coalitions. That's important. They're combining it, working with others. Our demands were actually much stronger. There were those who mobilized, who simply called for peace in Ukraine or no to NATO expansion, and much milder slogans. Actually, UNAC went right out with no to NATO and stop U.S. wars, and linked the war in Ukraine, the war against Russia, to the very dangerous and growing threats against China, but also the continuing sanctions now against a third of the world's population, the war on Palestine, bringing in the difficult issues, continuing war against Afghanistan, starving a whole country down, the blockade of Cuba. Let's talk about your unending. And it's, you got to put it in perspective if you're going to talk about Ukraine, because the U.S., through NATO, planned, orchestrated, organized, mobilized, equipped this war, and did so with constant missile attacks right on the Russian border against the Russian population of Ukraine. They did everything they could to instigate this war, because wars are profitable for them, and wars are their way of asserting their global dominance. And it's important that they have so utterly failed. The entire global South, all of Africa, Latin America, most of Asia, has refused to go along with the U.S. demanded sanctions. The European Union countries, Britain, they all dutifully passed hundreds and hundreds of pieces of legislation. And it has, as I say, impacted their economy disastrously. Ukraine is being used as a complete pawn. There's not a thought, a care, a concern for what's happening to the people of Ukraine, who didn't plan for this war and actually voted for what they thought was an anti-war candidate, a peace candidate.
Right, that's right.
Who's just a pawn of the U.S. completely. So I think we want to refuse to be demoralized. That's what they want from us. They want to silence us. They want to say nothing gets decided. The U.S. decides everything. And the whole world is saying no. Just by refusing to go along with the sanctions, what a statement. They thought the dollar was all powerful. Mm. And now even oil is beginning to be traded in the yuan, the ruble, you know, different currencies that never were thought of before as having international exchange. And now they are.
Yeah.
So we want to look at these changes that are happening, because U.S. hegemony, U.S. dominance is being severely challenged. This is not the end of the U.S. empire, but it is the end of them being able to call all the shots and just expect everyone to salute. And we are seeing a real frazzling, a fragmenting of NATO. We're seeing the impact it's having on the economy right here. And this will create a stronger and stronger movement. So the fact that there's 86 different cities, and we did this again in October, coordinated actions, and we were thrilled. I think there were 71 different actions. So it's growing. We're hearing actually still this week for more, because it was January. We set the dates of January 13th to the 23rd, the Martin Luther King weekend. It's actually week. It gives a couple of weekends in there for all different activities coming up. We took part in the action here in New York City, but there were 5 different events in New York, each of them challenging the U.S. war. And the very support for these demands put forth by UNAC of no to NATO and no to U.S. NATO wars, very important. And I think it's emboldened people in a very good way.
Thank you very much. Margaret Kimberly is also a board member of UNAC, and she gave us her perspective. We have, you know, this big war machine cranking up and ready to go, and a very slow-starting opposition. What kind of advice do you have for people about what we should be working on to try to stop this?
Well, I think the advice is the same. We should be, all of us should join organizations. We should take part in actions. We should write letters to our editors, write to our members of Congress to stop the proxy war, the U.S.-instigated proxy war in Ukraine, and to always talk about military spending and U.S. interference abroad. We just have to keep doing what we're doing. It's unfortunate that we have to, but we do have to acknowledge we have to work hard with elected officials. This war-making is becoming more and more bipartisan. It's unfortunate that even those who claim to be progressive when it comes to issues of war, they go, as they do with other issues, right? At the end of the day, they go right down the line. But it's up to us. It's up to us to have these movements. It's always the people who drive these things. So while we should lobby as well as we can or write a letter to the editor, we have to be out in the streets. People have to see us. And, you know, that's another thing. If people think they're alone, if they think nobody else agrees with them, if they think nobody else cares that $100 billion of our money is going to the military-industrial complex to use in Ukraine, where it's ultimately going to be blown up by Russia anyway. Right. If people think that no one else is concerned but them, then that's, it generates apathy and defeatism, and that's not what we want to do. So in short, we've got to do what we've always done. You know, one of the things we have to do to mobilize people is to talk about how it's connected with other issues. There are all over the country, they say there, I've seen the figure of 500,000 unhoused people. I'm sure it's 1 million. I'm certain that's an undercount. But nobody talks about giving people housing, and it's not complicated. You have to build housing, and that means the federal government. Biden hasn't given one speech about the plight of the unhoused, who are growing because guess what? How can you afford housing if the minimum wage doesn't go up for decades? So I think we also have to make those connections with other folks, people who are active on other issues, because people see the connections. That's why there's so much propaganda. That's why they had that love fest for Zelensky in Congress. That's to try to silence people. But I think a lot of things are going to come to a head, and that is a good thing to have a crisis. But we have to be there to provide the answers. You have to read blackagendareport.com every week. Black Alliance for Peace is doing a lot of work. Black-led organization, blackallianceforpeace.com for anybody who wants information. And we have to dedicate ourselves to fighting against these people, because at the end of the day, we really do not have a choice.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For KPFK, I'm Don DeBar.
The philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and also abandoned. But everywhere is war, there's such a war that until there are no longer we're first class nor second class citizens of any nation. You see, that until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, I've got to say war. Hey, that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, a bigger war. Now why? moralities, yeah. Remaining but a fleeting illusion to be pursued and still never attained, yeah. 'Cause everywhere is war, with such a war. I tell you, it's just war in the east and war in the west, yeah. War up north and then a war down south, yeah. I say a war, a war. And me I tell you about rumors of war. Still diddly war, a war.
That was Damian Marley, the youngest son of the legendary Bob Marley. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Today, in South Africa, there are regular and sudden massive power shortages in Johannesburg and Durban that are threatening jobs, health, and the future of South Africa. Pacifica's Steve Zelter recently interviewed former African National Congress founding activist Wiseman Hamilton, who is now a leader of the Workers and Socialist Party of South Africa.
So we're here today in Johannesburg. There have been power outages, power shedding, where the power has gone off in Johannesburg. This has been going on for some time. And also in Durban, there was a power shutdown for 17 hours. I mean, obviously, the crisis of capitalism and the whole government, ANC, is being exposed more and more to South African people. Why don't we talk about the whole, immediately, the crisis now of power and why the South African government can't supply power to people on a regular basis in the richest, one of the richest countries of the world.
It derives ultimately from the commitment of the ANC, not just to preserve capitalism as agreed in the negotiated settlement that culminated in the elections of 1994, but the adoption of the neoliberal growth, employment, and redistribution strategy imposed on the ANC without any democratic debate by a cabal within the ANC cabinet led by Thabo Mbeki with the support of Mandela in 1996. And what followed from that was the adoption of the prevailing neoliberal orthodoxies in global capitalism, which in the first instance led to the ANC completely abandoning the Freedom Charter, which, even though it wasn't a socialist document, contained clauses for the nationalization of the commanding rights of the economy, which, were it to have been attempted, would have required on the part of the ANC to mobilize the working class. But the working class would not have agreed to simply remove what they incorrectly referred to as white monopoly capital and install a black capitalist class as their new slave masters.
Some people who now say that under apartheid there were better conditions of transportation, of electricity, other things than today in South Africa.
Well, what was there has deteriorated. But I think it would be wrong to say that the conditions under apartheid were better, because such social services as there were provided only for the white minority at the time.
But the railways, a lot of the infrastructure has been destroyed through privatization. Isn't that the case?
Well, the irony of the whole situation is that to the extent that they've attempted privatization, that has not been a very great success. The reason that the ANC is only now attempting, through the new program of the dismantling of Eskom into three separate transmission, distribution, and generation units.
And Eskom is a national electrical grid.
Correct. Eskom is the national energy provider created even before apartheid, by the way, in the 1920s in the country. And they were warned, the ANC government, in the mid-90s, that unless the grid was upgraded, that there would be blackouts in 10 years. The government at the time was committed to the implementation of privatization and did not want to put Eskom on the market burdened with the debt it would be necessary to load Eskom with in order to finance the expansion of the grid. And at the time, at the same time, electricity in South Africa was the cheapest in the world under Eskom. That was not an attractive proposition for any potential buyers in the private sector.
They wanted a deregulated market.
That is what they proceeded to do. But the attempts to privatize Eskom were unsuccessful. And the only way in which the black capitalist class, whose interests the ANC historically represents, was going to be able to fulfill its own mission to try and rise to the summits of the capitalist economy was actually, ironically, to sabotage the process of privatization, keep it in state hands, take control of the appointments of senior positions in the state-owned enterprises as a whole, in order to ensure that contracts for supply of coal, for example, were directed to companies that were set up by the black capitalist class. So this is the irony, you see. What is described, I think, not completely accurately any longer, particularly after the Palapala saga and the ANC conference that followed, the so-called radical economic transformation faction. They don't really mean it when they say that they're opposed to privatization. What they want is to parasite on the state, and for that they need to control government in order to deploy their cadres into strategic positions within the SOEs to direct the tenders for the contracts of various things, repairs, coal supply, and so on and so forth, to their cronies, to the social forces that they represent. So, you know, that shows that the language that is being used is really to deceive the masses when they talk about privatization. There's equally an attempt to deceive the working class masses on the part of the lobby that wants to accelerate the privatization process. Because what we have here is a competition, the established capitalist class, in whose hands the system was intended to remain in line with the outcome of the negotiations that took place at CODESA. It's not an accident that the property clause in the new constitution requires a two-thirds majority in order to change. In other words, it would have prevented, if the ANC had continued to adhere to the Freedom Charter, the ANC to implement the nationalization clauses, because for that you need a two-thirds majority within parliament. So, in effect, what the constitution does is to provide for a minority veto within parliament itself. Even if the ANC had had 66% in the first election and wanted to implement the nationalization clause, they wouldn't have been able to do so. But the ANC, representing the black capitalist class, was itself not inclined to raise in front of the working class the possibility that they could, through social mobilization and a general strike, take control of the commanding eyes of the economy, because that would have meant posing the question in front of the working class of the necessity for the abolition of capitalism, the very system into which they had wanted to be assimilated. So that is the reason that there was no problem with them ditching the Freedom Charter, and even the reconstruction and development program, which was a mildly social democratic program adopted in place of the Freedom Charter, but ditched within 1996 in favor of the nakedly neoliberal care program that has resulted in savage cuts in social spending, in the relaxation of exchange control regulations, in the cutting of corporate tax from 52%, as it was under apartheid at the time, to 27% today. In other words, the consequence of the policies adopted by the ANC through the adoption of CARE meant that the tax revenues which they would have had to need in order to expand social services, at least to the same level as quality as it was for the white population, they denied it to themselves as a government. And as a consequence of the decline in tax revenue, a budget deficit opened, and they filled that budget deficit by borrowing on the international financial markets. The situation that we have today is where interest on the debt is the fastest rising item on the government's budget. So the ANC government is not in a position to solve any of the basic problems inside the country, because the requirement of neoliberalism is cuts on social spending in general. So to bring us to where we are with Eskom, They were warned, upgrade the grid. They failed to do so in from 1998 onwards, when they had even developed a white paper. The consequence of this was a deterioration of the grid over time and blackouts starting occurring in 2008. What made matters worse is that the country hosted the World Cup in 2010. And to avoid the embarrassment of blackouts during the World Cup, they redirected the maintenance budget for the Eskom grid to keep the lights going, aggravating the rate of deterioration of the coal-fired power stations and so on and so forth. The efforts that were made by the private sector, who have the capital, through the so-called independent power producers, again, concealing their real intentions of profiteering behind concern for the environment by emphasizing that they want to switch to renewables. Those deals that were struck, they had bid windows to allow the private sector to bid for the contribution towards the grid. Between 2011, I think, and 2014, enough deals were signed in order to avert a possible blackout, but they were never approved because the coal lobby, which is now 50% black owned, feared that the progress that they were making in switching the multi-decade agreements that characterized the coal industry under apartheid, and which they were succeeding now in getting switched to the black capitalist class, would become meaningless. And therefore you have a situation where the interests of the two wings of the ANC and the two wings behind them of the capitalist class that they represented are reinforcing the devastating consequences on the economy of the blackouts and, of course, on the conditions of the working class itself.
That was Wiseman Hamilton, leader of the Workers and Socialist Party of South Africa, talking about the roots of the catastrophic energy crises in the country with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. A solidarity rally was held in San Francisco at the Peruvian consulate on January 13th to protest the massacres and coup in Peru. Speakers talked about the right-wing organized coup to overthrow the Pedro Castillo government with the direct support of the United States. We'll hear from Lucrecia Bermudez with Colectivo Calchashun and Mission District community activist Cristina Gutierrez.
Ni un muerto más.
Ni un muerto más.
Ni un muerto más.
Ni un muerto más.
Nueva asamblea.
Nuevas elecciones ya.
Welcome, Lucrecia.
Good morning. Thank you for coming and showing support for the people of Peru and Latin America and South America. As you probably know, the crisis and unrest that has taken over the country, which started on the 7th of December, has claimed by now confirmed 46 deaths. Just on Tuesday alone, 18 people were killed in one town of Juliaca, in the southern part of Peru, the region of Puno, which is the border with Bolivia. Previous to that, the regions of Andahuaylas in Abancay, in Arequipa, Ayacucho alone had 10 people killed on the same day. Ica, La Libertad, we are seeing killings all over the country. Ucayali in the Amazon region. So what had to happen in the country is that the right wing, literally the right wing parties, which are really not parties by clubs, they supported and advised and trained by the United States government through its different organizations, being the USAID, being the National Endowment for Democracy, being the Embassy of the United States in Lima, being the 8th military bases that the U.S. has in Peru alone. We all thought that Colombia was the one with many, many bases in South America, but Peru has 8 and also has a biological center that was finally built in 2018 in the region of Amazons, which is the northern Amazonian region. It is clear because of the changes that have been going on in South America that the United States does, the Yankee imperialism will not allow South America to be let out of their hands. And Peru is the way in, strategically placed in the middle of the, in the center of South America, in the middle of the Pacific, and with entries to Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, Colombia, Chile, Ecuador. You can just get there from Peru all over to all over South America. So as the governments have changed and the progressive forces have taken on South America, the grip of the right wing and the U.S. in Peru has increased, incremented. It's now worse. This year, 2023, these are the nuances that probably we don't pay attention to. Yes. And so this year, 2023, there will be the 30 years of contracts that Fujimori dictatorship signed when they took over the country in 1992. And the reason for the extreme violence and the decision to kick out Castillo and repress the people forcibly is because they need to resign, they need to extend these contracts. Mining contracts, port contracts, Machu Picchu contract, gas, oil, they need to be, for them, for the benefit of them, they need to be extended this year. And that is the basic problem in the country. Now, I have to be clear and real, there is no strong political left party that can lead the resolution of this. But the people themselves, the comunidades, the Aymaras and Quechuas, and the indigenous Achanicas, they have come out and they are going to Lima. They took a pause for the holidays, and now they are again on the streets. They have come, around 50,000 Aymaras came down to Cusco, to the city of Cusco, yesterday. And one of their leaders was killed prematurely. And most of the leaders of the comunidades are being right now arrested. The Frente de Defensa de Ayacucho, the leader, the Secretary General, Lucero Leandro, was taken yesterday by the police. This is as the Prime Minister of the country, who is actually the one that is leading the country, and Dina is just a puppet. Dina Boluarte, the president, is a puppet. She has no way out. She has to stay there. So Otárola, the Prime Minister, has been very clear yesterday. They can't give up. Dina cannot resign, because if they resign, the whole thing crumbles and comes down. And that cannot happen. And that probably will happen, because more and more today, organizations and a couple of ministers resigned yesterday, and more regions are demanding that Dina Boluarte resigns and goes.
Our next speaker is Cristina Gutierrez.
USA out of Peru now. We need to understand that all this is the work of United States of North America imperialism. The people of Peru have been fighting for years for freedom and liberation, as well as the people of Colombia, of Chile, of Argentina, of Iraq, all over the world. In Latin America, Asia, Africa, the Caribbean, and the Middle East. We've been fighting for many years. Some of us are political exiled here. We didn't come for money. We came because we were persecuted in our countries. for the political belief that we had, because we wanted our country to be free from this country that has come to destroy the hopes and dreams of the peoples of the world and our people. So our duty, that's why I'm involved in the working struggle of the people in this country, because we had to defeat this country if we are going to be able to win freedom in our countries, to get rid of people like Dina Asesina, right? The new so-called president that they installed in Peru. To get rid of all those right-wing people that have destroyed the hopes and dreams of our people, but they keep fighting. I am so happy when I see the struggle of the peoples of Peru. I said victory to the people of Peru. Let us all say victory to the people of Peru. Victory to the people of Peru. We're not going to decide what's going to happen in Peru. The Peruvian people are going to decide what's happening in Peru. But we can decide what happens here and stop them from what they're doing over there. This is our job, our duty, brothers and sisters. We live in the belly of the beast. We live in the belly of the beast. And they are the ones who are doing this over there. So we need to confront this government. And we need to tell them to stop immediately interfering in Peru right now. To stop right now immediately. We need to denounce them. And we need to denounce this government of Peru, obviously, because they sell out. That woman, Dina, sell out.
Hands off Peru.
Hands off Peru.
Solidarity with the people and workers of Peru.
Solidarity for the people of Peru.
Victory to the people of Peru.
Those were the voices of Lucretia Bermudez with Colectivo Cal Shashun and Mission District community activist Cristina Gutierrez speaking at a solidarity rally held at the Peruvian consulate in San Francisco on January 13th. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On January 20th, the Bill Marsh Tribunal was held in Washington, D.C. to bring attention to the case of imprisoned WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange. The event featured expert testimony from journalists, whistleblowers, lawyers, publishers, and parliamentarians on assaults to press freedom and the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Here is American civil rights attorney Steve Donziger, introduced by the host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman.
Our next speaker is the American human rights attorney Steven Donziger, who is part of a team that won a historic $9.5 billion judgment against Chevron Corporation. For polluting the Ecuadorian Amazon. In 2019, he was targeted in New York with the first corporate prosecution in the history of the United States. Overall, he would serve 993 days under house arrest and in prison for a charge where the maximum sentence under law was 180 days. Steven Donziger.
Thank you, Amy and Shreko, and this wonderful panel. You know, half the battle when you sort of deal with the attacks, and I don't mean to compare in any way my situation to the cruelty that Julian is enduring right now, but half the battle is this. You know, it's the solidarity. There's so many people here. When I was in this long period of detention that I never could have imagined would happen in this country, because maybe I was a little naive. So many people came through for me and my family, just like people are here today for Julian, and I cannot tell you how completely uplifting that was. You know, part of the challenge when truth tellers speak truth to these entrenched pools of power is how to turn the attacks into opportunities. And as I sort of watch the trajectory of Julian's case, and I really haven't dug into it very deeply until the last year or two, by the way, when I read a book by Nils Meltzer. I don't know if you folks know the book, former UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, who has completely and meticulously documented that the US government narrative about Julian is a complete fraud. It is a complete fraud from A to Z. And Nils is not someone who comes at this from a movement perspective. Like, he's a serious clinical lawyer. And I would recommend, by the way, to all the journalists out there watching this, that if you have doubts about Julian, and if you have doubts about the case, and if you've been sort of maybe a little bit taken with, like, well, I don't know about that guy, that you read Nils's book. Because I can tell you, as someone who, you know, represented indigenous peoples in Ecuador for many, many years against Chevron. And for those who don't know, there's a bunch of stuff online, but Chevron, over a period of years, through Texaco, deliberately dumped billions of gallons of cancer-causing waste into the Amazon. And, you know, I went down there as a young lawyer in 1993, just like Julian started WikiLeaks. You know, you start thinking, hey, man, we can do these big things and make a big difference in the world. And when you're a little too effective at what you do, suddenly these entrenched interests of power, whether they be, you know, in the national security apparatus or the fossil fuel industry, they figure out ways to just forget the rule of law. You know, the rule of law, as is normally understood to be applied, and I get the fact in this country we've had a lot of problems through history of not applying the rule of law, not just recently, but as normally understood, the rule of law is not being applied to Julian's case. It was not applied to my case. I am the first person in US history, the first lawyer ever to be detained pretrial on a misdemeanor charge. And my misdemeanor charge was that Chevron had figured out a way to get a judge to order me to turn over my computer to their lawyers in the middle of the case, with all this confidential information. And when I appealed that order to a higher court, the judge charging with criminal contempt of court, he took his charges to the federal prosecutor in New York, who refused to prosecute me. And then the judge appointed a private corporate law firm to prosecute me in the name of the US government, without disclosing the fact that that corporate law firm had Chevron as a client. I was prosecuted in the name of the US government by a corporation. And, you know, when I sort of go through the experience, and I'm so happy to be through that piece of it, although I'm still dealing with a lot from Chevron, but I don't have my ankle bracelet. And I look at what Julian is dealing with, all I can say is it is absolutely vital that we understand the importance of Julian feeling all of our love and energy, and that we continue to spread the word. It is critical And I will say, as I look at Julian, I met Julian one time, by the way, a few years ago in the Ecuadorian embassy when he was there. But there is something big happening, whether he realizes it or not, through the process of fighting for his freedom. You know, it is a process of consciousness raising around the world. It can be seen as an opportunity to strengthen our freedoms, to strengthen freedom of the press, as is happening. And I just want to point out before closing that there is an increasing corporatization of these types of attacks happening in this country. Just this week in the United States, we had the first police killing of a climate activist in Atlanta. I don't know if folks know about this Cop City project. And there are now 15 people, by my count, peaceful climate activists who have been charged with domestic terrorism in the United States of America. We see in line three the protests in Minnesota, the pipeline company pouring millions of dollars into public police to arrest protesters. So whether it's the national security state, the fossil fuel industry, or other elements of the corporate class, we have a serious problem with our government in this country essentially being co-opted by elements that could give a damn about the freedom for the rest of us. And a few blocks from here, at the Supreme Court, which, by the way, is meeting today to discuss whether they're going to take my appeal of my misdemeanor contempt conviction. But that court, if you really think about it, has six justices now, four of whom were appointed by presidents who did not win their elections. They're unelected, and they're making decisions about almost every critical issue related to the freedom for 330 million people, including what happens, by the way, in Julian's case, ultimately. So we need to fight harder, and I don't mean to be sort of, you know, leave a message of that would might demoralize people, because whenever I'm asked to talk about my experience, like to law students, I'm like, no, you can really do this work. This work must be done, and it must be done. And as we see this increasing oppression, we must continue to organize, fight, spread the word, and really try to turn the resistance they're giving us into opportunities to advance the cause of justice. So I call on President Biden to step up. Come on, this is ridiculous. Drop the charges and free Julian Assange. Thank you very much.
That was civil rights attorney Steve Dunzinger speaking at the Bill Marsh Tribunal at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on January 20th.
Granddaughter, the water can hear you. The water has memory.
There is an ongoing work in Washington State to protect the watershed of the Nisqually people, native to lands around the Nisqually River, a huge source of life flowing through a national wildlife refuge and into the Puget Sound. The Nisqually environmental team honor the sacredness of the earth, salmon, and the waters by encouraging everyone to protect the environment, be respectful of all creatures, and lead by example. David Thunderbear, a tribal elder of the Nisqually and a member of their environmental team, recently shared this message and blessing for all beings on Mother Earth with Tanya Horlick of KMUD Redwood Community Radio.
My name is Klaatuch Thunderbear. I'm a tribal elder of many tribes. I'm here to share a thought or two for consideration of a peaceful heart. Teach by being an example. I am happy each of you came today. You each have a unique talent and potential, making the possibility of personal and professional success not only a dream, but a reality. Create your own measuring tool of wisdom and personal growth by asking and reminding yourself daily, What did I do? How did I do it? What did I learn? What difference did it make? When I was a young man, I asked three grandmothers picking huckleberries high in the mountains, when is the best time to plant a tree? The answer was, the best time to plant a tree was 300 years ago. Then, I asked, when is the second best time to plant a tree? The grandmother stood straight, squinting at one another in the glaring sun. Looking at the surroundings, one grandmother widened her eyes and looked into mine, then said softly, today. Each of you are present within the tree spirit, so please remember grandmother's message. Take and plant a tree. Watch it grow as you grow, knowing that generations from now, because your actions today, life will continue sustaining all creations. Because of the actions you choose in honoring and respecting the ways of our sacred teachers, at home or away at school, wherever you travel, good things will truly come to pass. Yes, each of you are a reflection of our ancestors' way of life, culture, and history. Walk in balance, peace, love, and harmony with all creation. Respect and honor your elders and earth. Live by being positive example and role model, providing unconditional love for all humankind. The inspiration and blessing shared among one another today is a lifelong reminder of how long we remember those that came before us. Ask yourselves today, as you go back to your families and communities, what do we owe our great-grandmothers and great-grandfathers that we could have what they could never have? Your freedom and education is a good place to look within, being thankful for their sacrifices. Ma se, thank you, all my relations.
Nibi.
Nibi.
Wabo.
Wabo.
Endayan.
Endayan.
Nibi Wabo. Endayan. Aki Misri. Nibi Wabo. Heya, heya. Heya, hey. Heya, heya. Heya, oh.
Water is the life's blood of our mother, the earth. Water is the lifeblood of our own body.
That was Sing the Song, written by Irene Wawati Jerome for Grandfather William Commander's 2002 Circle of All Nations Gathering. The Algonquin Water Song expresses loving gratitude for the water and raises the consciousness and connection of women with Mother Nature's greatest gift. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zelter. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.